agenda today is not exactly as it's laid out on the list of attendees. I want to walk you through so you'll know what to expect. We'll have an introduction by our president and CEO, Dr. John Hamry, and then I'll make a few remarks about where we are and where we're headed in terms of the CSIS part of this project. We'll have some remarks from our DOD sponsor, Kristen Baldwin, from the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and then Pierre Chow, who is really the generator and sustainer of this as it went through the process. We'll close it out. And then our intention is to open it up for discussion and dialogue and questions and answers and responses from each of you. So I want to thank you all for being here, and I'd like to try to leave as much time as we can, particularly given that I know you all had to work hard to get here today. You will also have to probably work hard to get wherever your next thing is, so we'll try to finish on time so that you'll be able to get back with your day. So with that, I'll turn the floor over to Dr. Hamry. Thank you, sir. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, David. And Kristen, thank you for making this possible. This was a very important effort and initiative. I think it reflects your insight into kind of the challenges in front of the department, and I'm really grateful that you'd give us a chance to be an agent here to help you with it. I would like to. My role here is an ornamental. I don't have anything substantive to offer, which always brings laughter to my wife's face too. I did want to say I think it's a very, again, the importance of this. I mean that you foresaw the importance of this. We're entering into a period where I think there's going to be just exceptional pressure and scrutiny on the Defense Department on how we buy things and what we buy. There is a, you know, it's very clear that we don't have a concept for what we're going to do going forward. I think that I've been watching carefully and parsing the Secretary's words, just like everybody else. You know, what the hell does this mean? You know, and try to figure out where this thing might be going. But I fear that the backdrop for all of it is a general sense that we're not very good managers in the department, and the evidence of it is that we take longer than we say it's going to take. It always costs more than it's going to take, and we're going to have so many poster child children of failure here, you know, that are going to become the backdrop of a big debate. I'm afraid that both political parties are reverting to their normal preferences when it comes to budget constraints. Democrats prefer social spending and Republicans prefer tax cuts. And nobody is prepared really to see a sustained investment in modernizing a defense establishment. And so we're going to be caught where the pressures are going to be great, and we cannot afford to have this continuing impression that we cannot bring complex systems to fruition on schedule and on budget. And that is really, unfortunately, the backdrop of public perceptions of us. So this is enormously important to say, is there a way we should be thinking about this in a different way? And my hat's off to our colleagues that have been working on this for the last year. They, of course, deserve a great deal of credit in pulling it together, but all of you have been so instrumental in helping us get to this point because you've been participants in the workshops and in the seminars that we've had where we've tried to wrestle our way through this. And I feel we have structural problems. I don't, I've never met anybody that went to the Pentagon in the morning looking to screw something up. I mean, that's not the problem. We have very earnest people working very hard, harder than most departments, candidly, trying to do a good job, and yet we fail structurally. You know, and so we've got to get at that. What is causing that? And that's the purpose of this effort. So I just want to say thank you, Pierre, for staying with it. Pierre is off becoming even a richer man, which is good. I'm glad for that. Somebody is making money in this environment. And but he continues to stay associated with us, and we're very grateful for that. Guy Benary, thank you so much for working with us on it. And David, let me turn it back to you to get this thing off for real. But I want to say thank you again, Chris. It was great to have you and all of you for being the agents to help us along the way on this important work.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. Before I turn the floor over to Kristen Baldwin, I wanted to mention a couple of things. You know, our goals for this publication in particular were really sort of twofold. One was actually to try to define and get our arms around what are we talking about when we talk about complexity and when we talk about complex systems. We tend to think of it from a defense industry point of view as major systems that are the results of contracts and procurement. But actually, when you're really talking complex systems, it's often much more comprehensive and broader than that to encompass really the entire national security operations. And then the second question is, what does it mean if we get our arms around it, if we get a definition or a working set of definitions, what does that mean for national security? What do we do differently? One of the powerful things that CSIS brings to any undertaking that it has is we actually try to put together an approach that leads to recommendations that could actually be implemented, where somebody can actually do something different. And I think it separates us from a wide variety of think tanks who often don't really ask that question of could our recommendations actually be implemented? Is there a pragmatic aspect to it? So that's what we have focused on all along. And the collection of these chapters that we have, of these papers that are written by a number of folks, some of whom are here today, actually, and I'm looking forward to their comments when we open up the floor, is that we actually have five challenges that are laid out for us that I think we need to tackle here. The first challenge is at the front end, at developing requirements. What are we looking to get? What are we as the national security community faced, and what are our tasks and challenges that we need to put into play, and how do we translate that into requirements that actually can something can be done? The next two challenges are really in the contracting process, the pre-award work. How do you translate those requirements into a statement of work? How do you put that statement of work into play so that people can respond to it? How do you evaluate and assess those responses and ultimately make a decision to award? And throughout the book, there are a number of examples of modest successes or setbacks in that regard. And then the second aspect is the post-award, the actual contract management. How do you get deliverables? How do you hold people, both the government and industry, to the standards that they've laid out for themselves? How do you assess whether or not you've delivered to meet those requirements? And I think this is a particularly difficult challenge because of the fourth problem and the fourth challenge we have today, which is the government has essentially lost an awful lot of its capability to be able to both to conceptualize and then to execute not only complex programs but even fairly simple programs. We could find a myriad examples even from support contracts for operational exercises in Iraq and Afghanistan where we have difficulty at the back end of the contracts, and in part because the government capability just simply isn't there. There's a tendency in the media, and I think you mentioned this from the political party's perspective as well, Dr. Hamry, there's a tendency to blame contractors for problems which actually at their core are the government's problems. And contractors make an easy scapegoat, obviously, and they're very visible, and they are, in fact, the ones who are cashing the checks and have to deliver. But all too often, the real core problems actually originate with the government. And if we don't have some effort to reestablish the government's capability here and to restore that capability back to what it needs to be, assuming we can tell what that is, then we're going to continue to have difficulties here. And then the fifth challenge is really there is no good overarching policy framework to wrap our arms around here. There's no good mechanism for saying, what should the government do? What do we rely on contractors to do? When we're talking about outside people, is it actually private sector contractors? Is it government labs? Is it federally funded R&D centers and university-affiliated research centers? Who is part of the team, and how do we put that team together? And what are the policy frameworks that that wrap our arms around? There is no basic strategy. There is no real articulated and usable policy framework there. So our way forward now with CSIS, with the release of this book, is to tackle those challenges from the point of view of, okay, now what do we do? because what the book gives us is a good survey of the realities today from a variety of perspectives and a good sense of what the issues are and what the challenges are and some of the options for dealing with them. But it doesn't yet offer the policy prescriptions, and I think that's our next challenge that we intend to undertake here. And we're going to invite all of you who would like to participate with us in developing some ways forward to tackling that challenge. So those are our next steps, and I think I lay that out for you as we proceed here today. With that, I would like to turn to the person who, as Dr. Hamry mentioned, we really would have had a great deal of difficulty getting any of this going had we not had the initial support from DOD and from OSD, the Deputy Secretary Gordon England, the Undersecretary for AT&L at the time, Ken Krieg, and particularly the support at the front end and all through our workshops and process forward from Kristen Baldwin. Kristen is the Deputy Director of Software Engineering and Systems Assurance in the Office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition Technology and Logistics in the Department of Defense. Sister Mary Catherine would be astonished if I could string that amount of words together and there's not a verb anywhere in there. But nonetheless, I think that, I look at your world, Kristen, and I actually don't understand where it has any boundary, because it seems to me that everything falls under software engineering and systems assurance at some level. So I would like to turn the floor over to you now for your remarks, and then we'll proceed. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. And thank you all to Dr. Hamry and to you, David, and to all you all who really participated in this work. I have enjoyed getting to read the final copy of it, and it does lay out just it's a terrific way to get us moving forward on this very important issue, as these gentlemen have already commented. A little bit about what's going on in the department right now in this area. I wanted to share that with you, commiserate with some of the things that you have put down here. And then, like David said, let's have some time for you to ask questions or for us to have some crosstalk before we leave here, and maybe we can talk about the way ahead and the way forward. Today's challenges and the challenges that David and Mr. Hamry had mentioned, they're not new to us. It's always been, as we know, pretty difficult to field and deliver on time, on budget defense systems. We think that what is magnifying these challenges, though, are the leaps ahead in technology that we've seen, problems that we uncovered, challenges in the 1980s with respect to software and those types of things. We found solutions to those, which have enabled us to do more or desire more or have more potential for these capabilities. And so what we think is we see happening is just a magnification of these challenges on our systems from this technology advances. The other thing that's happening is we want our forces to be capability-based. We want them to be agile. Our threat that we're trying to counter has become more agile and more adaptable. And so as a result, from the operational side, our systems are being more demanded of. And that's resulting in our desire to build more and more complex systems. So a couple comments here then, maybe some examples, just to look at what we're trying to field today in a couple key areas. Joint Strike Fighter, 3 variants, heavily software intensive, where we looked at maybe the F-22 in the 1980s, which was maybe half software function, if that. The Joint Strike Fighter is upwards of 90% function by software. Trying to be, and the F-22, whereas it is more of a standalone system. It can operate by itself. The Joint Strike Fighter, heavily integrated, interneted, net-centric mission area. And so that's just a tremendous challenge. And then on the manufacturing and engineering side, tremendous desire to ramp up production and manufacturing. So all of those to try to manage that and organize that and deliver that on time and really to even estimate that capability when we haven't done something like this before presents some challenges. On the information systems side, net-enabled command and control. Here's where we're trying to now replace existing command and control systems in the components with one joint command and control system. We've been trying to tackle this for years, and so now you magnify an an entirely software system with the fact that you're having to replace existing legacy systems. And I think your work has touched on this important fact that when we talk about our complex systems or our systems of systems, it's not just creating a new item or a new function out of whole cloth. What you're really having to do is create a capability by netting together existing legacy systems. And this is just tremendously complex in itself. Because, as you know, we don't have the funding or the resources to really just build entirely new systems. We will not replace all those systems with our current force structure. And so we must always have an ability to reach back into the old way that it was done. And so NECC has those types of issues that it's trying to face. And then another example is our Joint Integrated Air and Missile Defense. This is an example of a cross-cutting mission capability. And so think to yourselves over 200 systems that are trying to be netted together to deliver this capability. Those 200 systems or over 200 systems are owned by different managers and are designed for different purpose, but are now trying to be contributors to this overarching system of systems or mission area capability. So those just kind of give you some different types of examples of the complex systems that the department is trying to face and field. And as we move forward on, you know, is there a policy framework that we might even be able to put in place, or some procedures or decision management structures or governance structures, really have to be adaptable. And I know when Ken Krieg was the undersecretary, he was very much his intent was not to define a singular governance structure, but to recognize that there may be needs for different adaptable frameworks suited to the type of capability that we're trying to acquire, manage, and field. So those are just all considerations that we're really going through. You also, in your book and in your work, in the preface and in your remarks, mention these typical challenges. And what I want to stress from my perspective, because I put on my systems engineering hat, and that's where you stand is where you sit, right? So from a technical perspective, it's important to understand and recognize the governance implications, the funding implications, the contracting implications, the human capital implications, the fact that we don't have the resources maybe in-house that we used to, and we've had to decline a lot of our internal capability. But throughout all of those types of challenges, it's really important, and I react to something that Dr. Hamry said, that it's not just about figuring out what you're going to buy, it's figuring out what is feasible. What is the feasible capability that you think that you'll be able to deliver? Because if you can get your arms around that, the requirements trades in the beginning, the contracting options that you might have, understanding from our suppliers and from our community, getting them to be incentivizing them to tell us where are the real risks, where are the real challenges, what are the real feasible options. And that's where we see this area of systems engineering, which has thankfully emerged back into the department. We have strong initiatives to rebuild systems engineering capability into the departments, into the DoD community. And if you listen to Secretary England, when he was with us, he said this is a systems engineering is obviously a national shortage of systems engineering talent. So it's not just the department; it spreads across the nation. But my point here is that we need to address these challenges, address these issues that force our complex systems to be so difficult, and really address them from a technical standpoint as well. And I'll share with you a couple key initiatives on how we've been doing that in the department and our way ahead. One other thing to just some quotes for you just to be aware of. We've been tracking and analyzing the interdependencies between systems. So we may be fielding cross-cutting mission capabilities like, let's say, JIAMD or others of that kind. But we're also fielding single systems, but must make those decisions in context of those systems that they will be operating with, like a Joint Strike Fighter, very heavily interdependent on other systems. The Joint Strike Fighter is a single platform. Our DoD 5000 acquisition policy actually tailors quite nicely to a single platform. But that single platform has many dependencies upon it and is dependent on many other platforms. We did some analysis, and we do track all of these interdependencies when we review systems. And of 78, there are about 100 major defense acquisition programs that we oversee in AT&L. But on 78, an analysis of the interdependencies of 78 of them yielded over 1,000 unique interdependent relationships across over 500 systems, obviously ACAT 2s, 3s, and below. So this is another important consideration of how do you force a structure that allows you to not only focus on the capability that you're trying to get to, but those interdependency considerations. And those interdependencies are of the nature of operational interdependencies, where they're mission-related. There are programmatic interdependencies, where I'm relying on another program to build a certain component, and then I'm going to GFE that into my system, so a programmatic relationship. And then there's technical interdependency, of course, because we really truly are trying to interoperate. And so perhaps we're trying to net together the software or put together an architecture where we can plug and play a little bit. So that's something that we're also trying to increase our ability as we bring programs to decisions, as we review programs and assess their risk. We're trying to broaden our sights to be able to think of those programs in their context, so that when we make a decision on one, we're very aware of decisions that may have succeeding impacts down the road. So some key initiatives that we've had going on in this area of complexity and system of systems and interdependency is we just did release the new DoD 5000. You'll notice in there, among the other changes, is there's a heavy emphasis on pre-milestone B, pre-milestone A activity. And this is to bring into focus and oversight just some of the issues and challenges that you all have pointed out. Is what are the real requirements? How am I trading those requirements off? How am I really looking at the set of alternatives that in a very broad sense, not from a single service sponsor, but how am I really evaluating those potential alternatives? Then how am I engineering those into a program that is feasible, that I can bring to a milestone A, then that I can then execute a technology development phase where I can burn down that risk, where I can prototype key risk areas, where I can be thoughtful about pre-milestone A. The other thing is the contracting. How can I bring in interface with the supplier community? How can I bring those in? And then through the technology development phase, maybe have risk reduction contracts that I am able to use, so that when I come to a milestone B and I set my baseline for how I'm going to deliver this system, and I'll report to Congress and others on what the baseline is, what money I need, what time I need. We are hoping that we'll have much more informed decisions at milestone B by ensuring the rigor of the early life cycle. So that's what you'll see in the new 5000 and in our guidance and in our execution of that policy. Second, we did see in the last administration capability portfolio management. This was one of the efforts to really try to connect strategy to outcome, to try to have this contextual understanding, think of things in their broader context, how they relate to strategy, how they relate to the operational priorities, how they relate to feasibility and other things that may be able to deliver that capability. Those portfolio managers are still going strong. And I think that the next administration, it will be up to see how those CPMs are used and enabled. But it's actually, from our perspective on the inside, it's been very informative and useful and influential to have the capability portfolio manager sitting there and helping to assist and give broader understanding and contribution to the acquisition system decisions. So I do see that continuing, if not in its current form, then it must continue in some form, this broader context. Back on the systems engineering side, one key initiative that we've led within a systems engineering department is to understand the technology, the technical foundation of how do we engineer these complex systems? How do we get engaged early on to understand the feasibility, the technical risk? How do we buy down that risk? How do we help make the trades with the major system players from a financial perspective, requirements perspective? That's not something that has been done traditionally. The analysis of alternatives has been very much a trade between what we can afford, what the operational community wants. And so to the extent that we can develop guidance and competencies and understandings and tools and methods to enable the engineering function, the technical analysis, to engage in those early analyses of alternatives and pre-milestone A, that's very much something that we've written a guide. So we published from my organization, Systems Engineering Guide. It identifies key attributes of DoD systems from a technical standpoint, compares them to single systems. It highlights seven key aspects of what an engineer does that's working on one of these systems. And so we see this very much as something that we're going to now train to. We want to now hire to those competencies. We're going to be developing in the near term, a set of systems competencies that we can provide to our programs, that we can suggest, we can provide to our industry suppliers, because it is just important, the engineering function happens across the board. So it points out those seven key engineering attributes, and it also points out some emerging principles from the technical standpoint, tools, what's working well right now, and what are we going to continue to work on in this area. So I encourage you to find copies of that, talk to us about that, and we'll be continuing to pilot it with ongoing programs. And our emerging feedback, we've been working with about 20 different programs and organizations that do systems engineering, and the feedback is very positive. So they're finding it helpful, and they're finding it a good baseline that we can build on. So as a way forward, systems is going to continue to be a priority. I was not able to bring with me our new director of systems engineering, Mr. Gordon Krantz, who just joined us late in 2008. But as he looks in his vision of where he wants systems engineering to go in AT&L, he has said that systems is obviously one key area we must continue to get our arms around and provide a capability to the acquisition leadership and really the department leadership so that we can inform our decisions and manage our programs and our acquisitions. One other thing that we've, as a way forward, another key aspect of this solution for complexity is we've just awarded the first ever Systems Engineering University Affiliated Research Center. It's a UARC. It was awarded to Stevens Institute of Technology as the lead university. They are partnering as a co-lead with the University of Southern California Center for Systems Engineering, and they have a network of over 18 universities that enable us to tap into talent and research and people that can help us think through these challenges. And so we're extremely excited about this UARC and looking forward to implement it as a community resource. We will be investing a certain amount of funding in the UARC, but there is ceiling that is available for others to invest, and I think it forms a good opportunity for us to leverage investments in these important areas. So research is a key contributor to the way forward in this. And then governance. Your work talks a lot about organizing. How do we organize and govern the complexity? What we're doing from a OSD perspective is we're doing a lot of watching right now. We're hearing you've highlighted some key challenges. We've seen how the capability we're collecting and working with this capability portfolio managers to see how they are organizing to manage and sort of oversee their portfolios, and there's some elements in there. We see the services right now, the Army in particular, setting up a brand new systems integrator function. Because they found, actually, there was triggered by their last POM process where they found they really just needed to get a handle on these implications of producing capabilities. And so they've actually established government billets, staffing, ability to bring in new people, which is new for the department. We don't get to do that a lot. So they're staffing up. They're creating a system integration function. And as they do that, they're reaching out to systems engineers. They're reaching out to the communities, their PEOs, to be able to do that well. So that's something that we're working very strong with. We see different types, as I mentioned. Ken Krieg's philosophy, just for what it's worth, is, you know, different types of, we have directed governance structures, and you all mentioned some of them in here. Directed, there's more of a federated structure. We see some virtual structures taking advantage of technical capabilities where they don't even really, we don't really need to even acknowledge the fact that these systems or complex systems have these relationships, but we know that there are trades that must go on across them. So we're tracking all those kinds of frameworks, and what we need from you as we move forward, the challenge is, as you are experiencing these different types of frameworks and organizations for governing and managing, we need to work together so that what we see happening internally to defense, in our services, in the components, that we can actually have a continuing dialogue to share what you're experiencing and your perspective. One other thing that I might just real quickly mention is, from an industry perspective, we are establishing a system of systems committee under the National Defense Industrial Association. In the past, we've had great success with NDIA acting not only as one association, but being an umbrella association for us to bring in other industry. And I'll give you an example. We established a system assurance committee to react to the malicious tampering threat and the cyber threat and software threat. And I chair that committee, and we made it very clear to the broader community that NDIA, while being the head of that, we have NCOSI in there with us, we have AIA, we have ITAA, we have GEIA, we have OMG and others. So it's really been a very successful structure. And so as of December, our sponsors have made the decision to go ahead and charter a brand new committee, and we're in the process right now of actually writing that charter. So that's another opportunity to engage with the broader community. That might just conclude my remarks. We've got a lot going on. This is, as Dr. Hamry said, just a tremendous assistance and support. It's an important work that we need to keep pushing on, and I just wanted to share with you that there's sort of this technical weaving that must happen, these technical considerations that must happen as a part of all these challenges. So I thank you and look forward to any comments or questions that you have.
Thank you, Kristen. That was very helpful. I think, you know, when we sit here in Washington and we see a time of transition from, you know, the old administration to the new administration, there's always a tendency to have a little bit of a concern about, are some of the important issues going to be set aside? Is somebody going to drop the ball, put the ball down, wait for somebody else to come back in and pick it up? And it's really very, very satisfying and heartening to see so much going on, so that, in fact, the efforts that have been put into play, and you see it in Secretary Young's, you know, weekly memos. I mean, he reiterates many of these points as he speaks to the acquisition community inside DOD, and he reemphasizes and reinforces these points. And the new 5002 instruction that is out contains a lot of this as well. But that doesn't mean anything actually happens. It actually has to happen somewhere other than at OSD. It actually has to happen in the part of DOD that's doing the work. So we'll come back to some of these things during the open dialogue period. Let me turn now to our senior associate at CSIS, Pierre Chow. Pierre was my predecessor as the director of the Defense Industrial Initiatives Group, actually the founder of that group here at CSIS. So I'm delighted to welcome him back to offer his views and comments both on the state of play here and on whatever else he has to reflect on. Pierre?
Good morning. The project, as many of you know, started with a series of conversations with Ken Krieg at the time and Gordon England, with them mentioning that one of the largest problems they saw looming up ahead was the department's ability to manage and get under control large, complex projects. That set of conversations ran parallel with conversations we were having with Michael Schrag and MIT, and you probably deserve to be up at the head of this table as much as anybody else, frankly. Harvey Sapolsky as well, a lot of our industrial partners, Boeing, Lockheed, Northrop, where this has just been a constant topic that had been looming, and so we decided to jump on the topic, being entrepreneurial and sort of seeing a need to look into this. We started with some broad ambitions, as most of these projects usually do, to the extent that we'd be able to put together something like this and then have a whole series. We were also looking, frankly, to do a guidebook or a handbook for future program managers that they could easily look up the program that they have and draw a line and say, ah, here's what I'm supposed to do. Silly us, right? Because when we got up and running, what we found out, and one of the key elements that came out of this project is that in many ways this is still a new science and a new domain, right? And that doesn't mean it should stop us from doing it, because there has been periodic cycles where the complexity of the task at hand has overwhelmed the existing tools, and usually the government and in most cases the DoD has stepped up to the plate and developed a new set of tools, the new sets of infrastructures in order to do that. And for the historians amongst you, you can go back and, you know, the Gantt chart that has become ubiquitous was used in order to handle the development and building of dreadnoughts in the early 1900s when that kind of overwhelmed the system. Many of you are familiar with PERT as a programmatic tool that was brought about when we had to do the whole fleet ballistic missile submarine programs. And again, the system was overwhelmed by that amount of complexity, and so we created that tool. And the sense is that complexity curve has once again sort of pierced through the tools, and now that the time has come to generate the new set of tools for, you know, for this decade or this century. And so the project became as much about understanding where the state of play is in thinking about complexity and the management tools. It was as much about helping to create communities of interest. And so what I find very interesting is sort of above and beyond this work, there is a lot of other work that's going on in terms of organizations and communities surrounding complexity and complex systems management. So DoD is doing that with NDIA. The Australians have been very far forward. Lockheed's been sponsoring a group. I forget the name of the group now, with the UK, with a UK university. These communities are building, which, you know, tells you that people are sort of beginning to get to it. Santa Fe Institute is doing a lot of fantastic work on complexity theory. Sheila Ronis has been working with the Congress. good for you. Yeah, exactly. Good for you for taking on that challenge in terms of helping them think through, you know, issues of complexity. So we are developing the science. The underlying technologies are building, and so from that perspective, I think there are developing opportunities as well as technologies, modeling and simulation technology, which many think, as well as I, that that will be part of the keys to the kingdom of this, are evolving in this space. As well as new disruptive either governance structures or business models, you know, that are taking this on. There's a lot of cross. The one of the things that makes complexity complex is that it requires a lot of cross-disciplinary work, which is not how academia works, which is not how DoD works by its very nature, and in some cases, not how industry works by its very nature. And so you have to get physicists to talk to biologists, to talk to engineers, you know, let alone to get a molecular biologist to talk to an evolutionary biologist. And yet all of this work is being done by there. And so in some ways, everybody's got to go back to being Renaissance people when you could, you know, skip across those types of things. And yet there's a deep importance to doing this, right? Because every time we have managed to push back the boundaries or the frontiers of complexity, it allows you to do more and be more efficient, and whoever is the person that's able to push back those boundaries of complexity is the one that has the strategic advantage, right? Because those who are staring at complexity and calling it complex, they're calling that magic. And so when once upon a time there be demons, you know, once you understand the science and the technology, you push back those frontiers of complexity, you understand it. And if you think of the challenges at hand, the complexity of urban combat right now, there's a little bit of there be demons about that, and to the extent you can get some more insights and understanding about how exactly all those dynamics work, and that turns into a strategic advantage, just to pick one very pointed example. So as we were going through this work and effort, there's a couple of key things that really jumped out as we were proceeding through the workshops and processing the papers, and I would encourage in the Q&A or the opening discussion, you know, Guy and Michael and others, please jump in and chime in. But, you know, what really sort of pushed out, came out. One, in many ways, defense is pushing the envelope. All right, it's very sort of common mythology these days to sit there and say, well, the, you know, defense community lags. It's the commercial world that's pushing the frontiers in all kinds of places. This is one area where actually defense and government's pushing the envelope to the extent of the scale and complexity of some of the tasks that they're taking on. The systems integration of the Army through the FCS, if, you know, I can't think of too many other entities out there that are trying to integrate a 1 million person sort of entity, you know, in a broad system in the end. There is a difference between complex and complicated, and that's one of the most major things. Now, here we border on theological debates. The academics love having this debate forever, and we had to sort of wrestle some of them to ground to get to what we wanted out of that discussion, and this debate will continue, but it is an important element about this, and there is an element where we need to figure out, I think, from a management perspective, the ability to differentiate between the two, because the complicated, we've had 80 years worth of tools to address it. It's why we can build something like the F-22 or a Joint Strike Fighter, or I got to make sure I list enough projects from different companies so I don't get into trouble. C-17. What else do we have? F-22, et cetera, right? We can do these things. We know how to do them. We have the tools. It involves a classic scientific methodology of deconstruction and pathways, et cetera. Complex, which are nonlinear in their very nature, we have less tools to deal with them. And so if there's another message that came out, and it's one that we've done in broader work, one that David Berteau has always harped about, that one size does not fit all in the acquisition world. And if you try to apply the wrong set of tools to the wrong problem, you will get hosed up so quickly that you're doomed from the beginning. And so this differentiation between complex and complicated dominate a lot of our discussion and a lot of our thinking. The one size doesn't fit all is sort of element number two. Element number three is that there's that complexity in some ways is less of a technology issue and it's more about a governance issue. Now here we're reflecting our bias, right, in terms of what we wanted to focus on. There are lots of very and what Ken wanted to focus on. There are lots of other groups that are doing very, very good work on the technology of complexity and the management. So NECSI and other groups like that that are really trying to get their hands around it. We found fewer groups that are trying to deal with the governance issues. And yet from our perspective in terms of management of large complex programs, what we uncovered is in many ways it's about governance models, because one of the things that makes these things complex is the elements that were previously external to the program manager, the politics, the budgets, the coordination of multiple entities, were external to the program managers. It was somebody else's job. And yet PEO JSF suddenly has absorbed international relations as part of their main task, let alone somebody doing the gig or any of the more, you know, more of the complex problems. It's now subtly inside your bailiwick. The governance part of what we want to do and what David wants to take on going forward, I think, is extremely important and probably some of the most value-added elements that we can do. And if you think about it, that's what we've been experimenting with LSI, with other models, et cetera, right? They're in essence governance models. The sort of fourth thing is, I'm going to coin a phrase now, Chow's law of conservation of complexity. To the extent that some people are running around sort of saying, well, if you want to solve the complexity problem, that's simple, don't make it complex. Let's just simplify things and deconstruct it. And yet what you find out when you deconstruct it, you have coordination costs that you've got to do now to tie together your now deconstructed and simpler systems if you still want to do that. So then you sit there and say, well, fine, let's all put it back together again, and I'm back in there. So if you think about it from a broader, again, Secretary DepSec Def AT&L perspective, I have not solved anything by sitting there saying, let's break this apart. I have, you know, that amount of complexity is still there. It's renamed. It may be simpler from a program manager's perspective, but from the department's perspective, that level of complexity is still there. So, i.e., the short message is there is no cheap and easy way out, right? Which then brings you to the next point, the budget implications of this. And this is something I'm sure that Kristen can really resonate with, right? There is always the danger of systems engineering and all the elements and all the things that we say that we need to do in order to solve this complexity, which is a lot of upfront thinking. The historical tendency has been that's the stuff you throw overboard in the budget cuts or in a tighter budget environment because it doesn't buy you another 10 pounds of metal. It doesn't get you another 10 circuit boards. It seems like a bunch of arm waving, and yet it is exactly the thing that down the line saves you a whole bunch of money. But when you're going through these massive budget drills, it to maintain that discipline, and I think that will be the test of any administration, is as we take on these large complex systems, the budget discipline to put the money up front and sustain it, which again is why Sheila's work with the Congress is important in making sure that on the congressional side there's a deep understanding that this is actually extremely value-added components of what you do from being able to fund it, I think will be another major topic and is one of the topics that came out of the workshops. The last element that popped out are sort of the industrial base implications, because I think, once again, there is a tendency to try to whitewash or say one size fits all. In reality, you need an ecology of companies in order to deal with this. By their very definition, these large, complex, integrated systems, frankly, cannot be executed by small companies when it comes time to doing the detailed engineering component of this. And so there is a role for the large primes. There is a role, or there can be a role for smaller companies to the extent that there are slices of analysis and other things that as we go through this debate of what is inherently governmental, what should be done, what poses conflicts of interest or not, and we're still trying to define where that boundary is. There are roles for other types of entities to deal with that. We touch on it in the book. We touch on it in the workshops. I suspect it will be fruitful space for David to continue to mine as Kristen does her work in terms of finding out where exactly that line is, as well as because this is such a newly formed place, there will be room and roles, I think, for some pretty disruptive business models and disruptive approaches. I would consider the prize strategy as in some ways a governance structure to try to get you through a complex, you know, situation, to the extent of if I can't figure out how to define what I want, offer a prize for something and let the marketplace, in this case for the robotics challenge, the marketplace was that actual challenge to give you the answer to the problem, right? In some ways, we had long debates. Did anybody actually really design the internet or not? Because there's mythology and there's right. Well, aside from the infamous claim, there is real debate about, you know, there is an invisible hand dictating certain parameters to the internet, and yet a lot of it is sort of left to form on its own. Again, these types of governance structures where you set some loose parameters, but then you let a marketplace dictate it, which has been behind all of this talk about how do you bring sort of biological models into it. And that loops directly back to the budget implication issues, because those types of models, which calls for lots of experimentation, lots of fly-offs, lots of trades, is initially expensive and will look initially wasteful because there will be 8 failures for every 2 successes. But I suspect if you were to do it over its full life, is cheaper. And how do you convey that message to Congress, to even the budgeteers, to others, that no, in the end you are saving money versus not, which may be different again versus a complicated one where I know what I want and it's just a matter of assigning it to somebody to go and execute the complicated task as opposed to a complex task. So we went through a long journey. We learned a lot. Hopefully most of those things are in here. As a good think tanker, we left more things to do for others to go and pursue. But it is an important task at hand, one that I think we're all sort of collectively trying to find our way. And if we've even added, you know, one iota to the debate, I'll be happy. So with that.
Thank you, Pierre. I want to do a couple things before we open it up. One is I want to recognize some of the staff that made this possible. Dr. Hamry already mentioned Guy Ben-Ari, who serves as my deputy in the Defense Industrial Initiatives Group. And I will tell you that when I arrived into this position, it was with the fervent hope that this task of putting this book together and out was going to be already done. That such was not the case. It was a complex system. I have spent some time in academic communities, and I understand completely the difficulty of moving academics towards a common goal on a timeline and a schedule with that we had here. But Guy was relentless, and actually, without his efforts, we would not be where we are today. In fact, I don't think we would ever have gotten there. And so I think we all owe him a debt of gratitude there. I would also like to recognize Matthew Zlatnik, who has helped us on here as well, and he and Guy collectively wrote the front end of the book there, the introduction. Tara Callahan and Joachim Hofbauer, who have supported this effort of this conference and will be supporting the follow-up work as well. So I want to express my gratitude and the gratitude, I think, of everybody involved in this. I would also like to reflect a couple things in summary here. I had the privilege a couple decades ago of being the executive secretary of the Packard Commission, which actually tackled some of these questions well in advance of any ability to manage data, because in those days we didn't have systems that let us use data, and if we did, they were too expensive to actually store the data and retrieve them. But we looked very hard at the question of where are there comparable challenges out in the rest of the world. And there are plenty of people trying to manage complex operations and complex systems. In fact, if you look at the stimulus package that is on the House floor today, that's the ultimate challenge. It's managing the global economy. And there, I think we're still woefully short of either tools or data. But we're gonna proceed nonetheless. But there's a fundamental way in which the government is different, and particularly defense is different. And that is that what defense does, it consumes for itself. Defense is ultimately the customer. And in many ways, the rest of the complex systems of the world, including much of the rest of the government, the customer is outside. The customer is somebody else. but in defense, in national security, and to a limited extent in NASA also, particularly for manned spaceflight. There's a dynamic there that's sort of self-looping. It comes back onto itself, and you've got to live with the consequences of your decisions in ways that are fundamentally different than the vast majority of large systems management in the rest of the world. And I think it's useful for us to keep that in mind, because not only is the analytical way we approach it shaped by that, but in particular, the prescriptions of what do we do about it has to take that into account. There is ultimately a very strong life and death element that comes into the equation. I think it's incumbent on us to constantly recognize that and use that to move forward. And with that, I think I would like to actually offer to Michael, as the author of our lead chapter there, chapter two in the book, if you have some comments you'd like to make before we open the floor up, I'll give you this opportunity.
Very, very brief comments. I want to second your compliments to Guy, and I'm just sorry that Harvey Sapolsky from MIT isn't here. It was a wonderful workshop, and CSIS was a fantastic convener for this. My brief technical policy thing sort of links something that Pierre was saying and Ms. Baldwin was saying, and that I do think there has been, please do not hiss at the use of this phrase, a paradigm shift in systems engineering, in that when we look at the Simon Ramo, Bernard Schriever days, we're talking about systems engineering as coordination and integration. And increasingly, when you point out these interdependencies, the issue revolves increasingly around collaboration and interoperability. And I think, as I see some of the demographics of this, optimizing around integration is a completely different task than optimizing around interoperability. And that creates governance issues, technical issues, policy issues, and budget issues. And I think that's one of the questions that we want to discuss in this open forum.
Thank you. Well, with that, let me open the floor up. If you would identify yourself and your affiliation, and if you don't have any, you can just say you're unaffiliated. In the state of Maryland, that means you're registered independent. Have at us comments, questions, challenges, or opportunities here. Robert.
Well, first of all, I'm Bob Vilhauer with Boeing Company, and again, I'd like to commend the group for not only doing this, it was very useful from our perspective, but allowing industry to participate in it, so thank you for that. I kind of wanted to pick up on the comments just in terms of, I was disappointed that we fell short of creating the handbook that Pierre had envisioned originally. I understand all the reasons why we can't have it, but in terms of going forward, I think one of the key things that is not well recognized, and Sheila, you may have views on this too, is I don't think policymakers have a good appreciation for what systems engineering, integration, any of that even is. And so I think, you know, as a community, we have to do a better job of educating people on exactly what is the value of that at the front end of a program to execute it better at the back end. So as you go forward, I would just, I hope we can focus some, effort on a broader education of people on these important concepts, because to me, that's kind of where we're losing the war here.
Yeah, this is something that we have struggled with, I think, strategically, and we've tried, and we're hopeful that that with the administration change, it will have opportunity to speak anew to people, because it always creates opportunity to talk about what you're doing again. And as we do that, we want to have as many avenues as we can to try to tackle this longstanding issue, really. But the point I really wanted to add to is it's not just leadership in Congress; it's actually leadership inside of our department. The senior officers need to also, and the resourcers and the requirements folks that want everything as soon as they can get it. We really have to have an understanding of this investment up front and what that can afford. And so we're looking not only externally but internally to our own department as we can define what upfront engagement, early systems engineering is. We need to go out and immediately communicate the resource needs for that to our resourcers inside our own department.
One of the things we were looking for was actually any kind of ROI work on systems engineering, and it was really thin on the ground. It was shockingly thin. So if there's a message I'd send back out there, either in the business school community or somebody to do that work, it would go a long way.
David Dompkins from Australia. You might look at some of the things we've done at home in respect of that. I think the reason we were moderately successful over the last couple of years is we managed to convince senior parliamentarians and our ministers that this was critical, and the senior people in the Department of Defence and our Defence Material Organisation to support us. If we hadn't had that, if they hadn't declared that this was a critical issue to the country, we wouldn't have got where we've got. I'd also suggest there's probably a lot to learn. Australia's a small little place, and being small, we're much more agile, and things are quite urgent to us. So we've done a lot of things over there outside of defence, where the defence industry has learnt from, rather than defence leading. And in respect of the standards, the governance contracts, we're actually very well advanced with those and have been using them for almost two decades now. So there's a lot to be learnt, but the critical thing was leadership. If we hadn't had that in the government and then in the Department of Defence, we wouldn't have gone anywhere. And that is still driving it. It's interesting, over the last 2 years, though, in the work, we've got support from British government, Singapore, Canadian, Boeing, Lockheed, Raytheon at a senior level have been major backers to us in what we're doing. The one notable exception and the one place we've had the most resistance is US. Your Defence Acquisition University, we went nowhere with whatsoever, in spite of many, many debates over many days and weeks, intransigent in their attitude. And in getting involvement and feedback from the Defence Department in any way to support, we developed an international standard for complex project management, signed off by the major corporates and the other governments. No involvement whatsoever from here. So all the work we've done, we've had no interest and no involvement whatsoever from the Americans.
We're not.
We have spent so much time over here on so many trips, and it's been almost fruitless. But ICAF would be the only place that there's been any interest. ICAF, I would say, in the discussions we had with DAU, they openly got up and said, look what we have to deal with. You can see why we have the problems. We're not going anywhere in dealing with DAU. That was their comments. They understood, and we had some interesting discussions with them, but that's the boundary. As far as participation, Stevens University have been helpful to us. We've worked with them extensively. They've been a part of that. We developed a new course to develop complex project managers funded by the government as a critical issue. Our first lot of graduates are already out, second cohort going in, World Bank backing us. But we couldn't get DAU to participate in that in any way.
I think we'll consider that to have been laying effective groundwork for further action. And we'll pick it up and work it in that regard. Other comments, reactions? Yes.
Yeah, David. Wayne Schroeder, Lockheed Martin. One of the major issues facing the aerospace industry, and also I think the government and even our country, is the graying of the workforce, the need to increase STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and math. What observations, what recommendations were in the human capital section? I think, David, you wrote it. And how do you – what are the steps that need to be taken to deal with this issue over the long term, since it takes years to address this issue, and we have to really look even as deeply back as K-12 education to get young people interested in this field?
I suppose the answer is not an easy one ever. We had a real issue in Australia with ACAT 1 and ACAT 2s. The government mandated that you had to be certified. We established a new institute by an act of parliament, complex project management. So we formalised that. We actually then mandated that people had to be certified to that standard if they were to work from either the government or the private sector on ACAT 1 and ACAT 2 programs. So mandated it. Then we had a problem. We didn't have anybody inside government or industry in Australia that we could certify. So, catch 22. So we set about identifying what we believe was high potential candidates, and we structured a process to do that in accordance with the standard. And the standard was developed, I wrote most of it, but it was developed by people like Tom Burbidge, JSF, the guy that led Future Combat System, etc. We had 12 of the world's top guys work with us do it. So it reflected reality. So we used that to develop, identify key people. Most of them were 25, sorry, the youngest was 25, very young. We wanted to try a young person. Most of them were 35, 50, people that had done it before in the complicated area. And then we put through a process of actually fundamentally changing their mindset to fast-track the development. All the people we found running these programs were over 55. So what we were trying to do was put old shoulders on young, over 55. Everybody over 55. We didn't find anybody throughout the world that we could certify, and we had a peer review process. So we said, how can we try to put old shoulders on young heads? So we looked towards identifying young people, pre-selecting them through a battery of processes and fast-tracking them. So far, the experience looks good. We've had our first graduates out, and we're mentoring their development over the next 12 months. But Australia now has its first batch of 24 people that we can really say have the base competencies of underpinning knowledge, cross-sectional stuff that Pierre talked about, to actually do this. So we've done that. What it's meant in other places, we've now got a cohort of universities around the world taking this up. Stevens is one of them. But I think there's probably a dozen universities now. We've been running, we set up another thing called the International Centre for Complex Project Management that's promoting research and running research workshops. And we've got probably a dozen to 20 universities around the world now looking towards doing this. So it started. And it'll filter through, it'll take time, but it's happening.
This work... That question and was something that we spent quite a bit of time on in the workshops and also in another project that we did with Kristen's group about software engineering and did we have the right skills. And in all, the results were interesting that one, you don't need a lot of these people at the very high end top. It's literally handfuls. It's dozens, if not, you know, low hundred in terms of your A-class systems engineers, complex systems guys. And MIT had done quite a bit of work on who these people are. They probably did the most comprehensive survey, so it turns out they are older, that there is actually a psychological profile. So in other words, they are the way they described it is they are born and honed. Not made, okay? But there's two elements to that. There's the born part, so it's in your innate nature, but honed is the other part, and that's the part where, again, if you're only doing one program for your entire career, that is not honing a systems engineer. You know, honing means working on multiple programs, failing, learning, things, again, that both industry and the government are hard to do. It means having somebody who worked in naval engineering, transferring them over and working on an aircraft program. Which is heresy in lots of places, you know, et cetera. Easier in a smaller country where you can, you almost by nature, you're forced to do that. So there's element about the which also means that this is a problem that will not be solved overnight, because the other element is it takes anywhere from a decade to 15 years to hone these people. And so we have something to do, or we have an issue for the next decade. Even if today we were to snap our fingers and say this is our top priority, it would take a decade to 15 years to get to where we want to go.
Just one point on that. You've got one further problem.
I'm going to have to cut that discussion off, because I do want to open up the opportunity for additional comments on other areas here. We will take that one under consideration as part of our follow-up activity, and actually there are quite a few initiatives underway that I think we can take full advantage of. I would point out that in addition to born and honed, there's a black box in between, which is somewhere you need to recognize, identify, and bring into play. And that's probably where the government has the greatest difficulty of all, is actually hiring somebody in the first place. But I do think we need to take that one on. Other comments on other areas? With that, I think, you know, we can't see out. Oh, I'm sorry.
I have one.
Yes, Dr.
As part of the project on national, Sheila Ronis, Walsh College, and the project on national security reform here in town. As part of our next phase of the project on national security reform, we're going to be looking at how to develop and think through a number of complex systems issues regarding national security in its broader context. But one of the things we're specifically looking at are models to try and calculate risk across multiple areas, political, economic, and, you know, looking at your classic military situation and then saying, but what are the economic risks associated with that? And it's in that interplay of risks that we're going to have to merge different tools and techniques that if anyone has interest in that. I would love your card. And if you have experimented with these kinds of risk models, I would love to see them. And I would recommend that maybe there are things we can do together, because that's going to be part of at least my responsibility for this next year.
Well, most of those systems actually didn't go through an in-depth deep systems engineering up front before fielding. So and the other hard part that has been hard to prove is the only way you can get really good data would be to start two simultaneous programs. One, not do any systems engineering and just kind of launch into another one, spend a year doing the planning and then running them parallel and seeing which one came out at the end, and no one in their right mind would sort of run that just as an experiment. So there's a lot of the thing that's tripped up people in terms of trying to do some rigorous analysis is you're trying to prove the absence of something, right? And I think that's what's tripped up a lot of people. There's been some work at trying to do that. It is anecdotal. If you want to find something, you can find something in it. But if you want to poke holes at it because they sit there and say, well, it's not statistically large enough, you're always going to suffer from that weakness. So you almost have to scan across time and across the globe to get a big enough set to sit there and say, was the $1 billion put up front in doing nothing? Actually, that's too high. But systems engineering worth blank. That's essentially the issue.
But I would point out particularly that we need to matrix that, because Ms. Baldwin pointed out the emergence of capabilities managers. And presumably when you have capabilities, you have within those capabilities swap outs. You can use this kind of weapon system or that kind of ISR system. And I think one of the things I would hope we would be discovering from these capability portfolio managers is under what circumstances do you get better results from this subset of the capabilities portfolio versus that subset. And I assume you're doing work in that regard.
Right. So I would like to make a couple comments. I completely agree with both of your comments. It's very difficult to measure something that's intangible and a prevention of a bad thing for several reasons. The newness of what we're doing internationally, what we found in my work with International Council on Systems Engineering is there is a cultural sort of a terminology thing, boundary that we must overcome. Everybody does some sort of best practice, but we don't call it the same thing in many other countries. Countries don't admit to doing systems engineering, and so we're in the data collection effort. You just have that initial hurdle. The whole idea of trying to the other big thing is the variables, the multiple variables that go into something with a bureaucracy like the Department of Defense, the political motivations, the service unique motivations, the different options and different things that go into making a decision or having an outcome on a program are just tremendous to try to tease out what was the contribution of good systems engineering has really been a challenge. A couple things that we're trying to do with industry, actually, we in 07 timeframe, we constructed a survey that went out and I believe got upwards of 100 different program responses from our industry partners that talked about effectiveness of systems engineering from their viewpoint, how it was being implemented into their corporations, into their programs. And so we had a survey, some survey feedback come back, and we're now trying to tease out what correlation can we come up with that and where do we take that. So that's a survey type of thing. What we're also doing, part of my organization, for all major defense acquisition programs, we do a systems engineering technical and management assessment before they come to a milestone decision. We capture all of the findings from those assessments. We call them program support reviews. We have a PSR database, over 3,000 findings from each of those, and we've categorized them. So now we're doing root cause analysis in order to understand what is happening. What are the causes of that, and then maybe we can make some corrective action. And then over time, the key here then is we can now do some comparison of, okay, now we instituted new best practices, but we're not there yet. It takes time to collect that kind of data to provide that foundation. So
we may have to go to real option models or something like that to try to get it behind, because in some ways that's what it is. The other point you made is also worth bringing up. The fact that you have, and we've talked about this a lot, you know, kind of a barbell-shaped system with one end of the system that's pegged on the war of today, and that's all about time, right? How can I get something out fast, which runs against all of this that we're talking about, which says you want to take your time in thinking about it before you put it in for the larger, more complex things?
I forgive this. This is a big issue for me in terms of design. Everybody knows. Everybody who writes knows that you don't write something, you rewrite it. It is absolutely imperative, and, you know, you have war fighters. As we've seen from both Afghanistan and Iraq, a lot of the most weapon systems have been made effective is through improvisation and adaptation. And to do systems engineering design that minimizes or undermines the ability of the warfighter to successfully adapt and improvise, that's bad systems design, even if it conformed to the original requirements. So this is one of the issues that we have to deal with, and this is why issues of interoperability, layering, mashups, et cetera, this is important not just for the 10 to 20-year time frame, but what do you do in the next 6 months?
I think that's all part of it. I mean, there's little components of each, the budget issues, the fact that it's model-based, that you can't sort of touch it and feel it when you go up on the hill, or say, you know, what did I get for my money? You know, that's why it's as much a communications challenge in these early days as it is a real challenge of trying to figure out the real solutions to it.
I think there's another element that comes into play there, too, and I commend it to Dr. Ronis as she does her risk assessment work, because the way in which we think about risk is fundamentally different when we're adapting in an operational environment than it is when we're operating in a normal development and acquisition environment. I think you ought to look at that as a tangent, I think, of your effort there. Did you have something you wanted to throw in?
Graham Smart from TALIS. I was really just going to pick up, and Pierre just said it, on this sort of dumbbell kind of dilemma that it seems we've got, because clearly when we talk about congressional understanding and other bodies that need to understand it, there's real danger that there is an opinion out there that things get over-complex, that we set ourselves tougher goals than we need to set for the mission that we've got set out in front of us, particularly in the short term when we've got two wars going on. I'm interested as to how do you keep both those agendas going, because one agenda can actually sort of devalue the other one quite easily, and I just wonder how you're going to try to keep both of those alive at the same time.
I think from an implementation point of view, the time element comes very powerfully into play there, because often what looks very successful at the front end in the early stages, it turns out as you play this out and you start looking at real life cycle operating costs and life cycle management and sustainment over time, you get a very different equation. So what may be an early success from a near warfighting perspective may actually end up being a little bit of an illusion as time goes by. Fortunately, technology tends to offset that, but that only assumes that you can actually buy it and incorporate it, which is another challenge that we have in the government in that regard. Let me ask, we've got a couple of other of our authors are here, if any of you have anything that you would like to throw in as well, open up that opportunity. Anybody?
Jeremy.
So, Jeremy?
What I find really stunning, and Bob Vilhauer and I have had this discussion, is that on the transparency comment, in taking on that LSI role, the government has had more transparency deeper down into that program than in any traditional prime contractorship role, right? Given the way that was set up, transparency to the point that it hurts is a comment sort of that jumps out. And that's, I think, an underappreciated element or component of, frankly, of how, for example, that program has ended up evolving.
Hi, Doug Norman from the MITRE Corporation. I'm reflecting back on Dr. Hamry's initial opening remark where he suggested that there's probably some systemic issues. And we've been talking around the edge of the systemic issue. I think David probably bopped it pretty good initially, but we we deflected that. I also like to hitchhike on something Michael started, and I'm going to take it a little farther. Probably he would take it farther still, but just hitchhiking on this, and that fast has a quality all its own, as does large, and we tend to discount that. But if you believe some of the comments that were made, that this is ecosystem-like and evolution and adaptation-like, then you recognize that your ability to adapt and the speed of adaptation is inversely proportional to your generation time. So if one wants to approach a real need, then one can in fact take the notion that we want to be as fast as possible in our generation time. And that actually switches system engineering from the notion that's been proffered today by Pierre, I would quibble with you, Pierre, from careful thinking up front to carefully putting together the infrastructure wherein good ideas can be brought, not according to a schedule, but according to appearance and great ideas. And then they get vetted within, I'm going to call it a marketplace, of real operational effectiveness. And it's that, completing that loop and allowing that feedback to occur, I think, that will drive that. And that actually looks like a natural system. So I would offer that as one of the insights I get from listening to the discussion.
If I led you to believe that I thought that systems engineering was a solution to complex problems, I have grossly failed, because systems engineering is a solution to complicated problems. A new model of governance is the solution to complex, which will tend to be more towards the...
I'm just quibbling with a couple of the remarks that where you said that system engineering...
No quibble, just to argue.
Well, I'm trying to be polite about it, you know.
No need to.
The idea being that we have to have careful thought up front before we do something. Now, I think that's absolutely true in those areas where we have key convergence points and protocols, because those actually have to have a very low variety in order to allow great variety on both sides of it. So those are key places where one, in fact, ensures that you shrink the set of variety available, but the benefit we get in the ecosystem is in fact realized by allowing great variety on both sides.
So I'm with you 100%. Let me make the only quick comment. I'm with you. So again, I think we're just miscommunicating, because the element about running the competitions, and so again, use prizes as an example, whatever, which is a way to get to complexity, and running multiple cycle times and evolutionary models in order to let the marketplace of ideas solve that is in all the work that we've done, seems to be the only way you can get to solving this complex thing. Here's the one issue. Because if you're going to, the thing about evolution that's very efficient is that it kills things. And one of the things that DOD doesn't do is kill things. And so you have mammals running with dinosaurs sort of all the way through. And so if there is clever thinking up ahead, it's in these governance structures of how do I allow ideas, how do I fund the fact that I want all these ideas, because again, it's going to look horribly wasteful initially, and how do I set up a set of kill mechanisms to weed out the bad stuff.
It only looks bad and more expensive if you consider that, if you restrict us only to doing development contract thinking. And so if, in fact, we can take the non-recurring engineering and move it elsewhere, it'll look bloody smart. So let's imagine, I mean, look at all the variety that's available to us in our day-to-day lives. And how does that variety come to be? By the way, variety is an interesting point. Again, if you believe in this ecosystem evolution idea, then a key is variety and then selection amongst the variety available. So we don't do that. We tend to reduce variety. In fact, our notion of portfolio is more seems to be more defined as avoiding redundancy, and that's a key word, redundancy, because that's the flip side of variety. Avoiding redundancy as opposed to providing a collection amongst things to choose from. And by avoiding redundancy, and that's the green eye shade definition or observation, we tend to pre-select things prior to their vetting in operational environments. And so we select at the wrong point, I would offer.
If you hang on a minute, David, let me offer a couple of comments that I think tie it back to what the Defense Department is actually trying to do today. And I think you've raised a number of very interesting points here, Doug. On the question of fast versus large or complex or lengthy, it's interesting to look at what Secretary Gates said yesterday in his testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee. And, you know, we're all watching what this secretary says very, very closely, obviously, because we've got an unprecedented situation here. We have a holdover from the previous administration who's continuing, and that's never happened in the history of the Department of Defense. And we have a situation where for years he has been saying things, and those of us who look at what he says look carefully to find where it actually impacts programs and budgets, and we're finding that that connection has been rather thin over time. So we're waiting to see whether or not it thickens under the current administration. But he said, you know, we need to pay attention to getting stuff that's the 70% solution more than the 99% exquisite solutions. And, you know, the typical tendency of the analyst is to interpret his words, meaning it's only going to give me so much of my requirements. But it may be that, in fact, what he's saying is get it here a lot faster, and however much I can get, I'll take. It's sort of like the idea that was bandied around about a decade ago of a fixed-priced R&D, not from the point of view let's require contractors to bid fixed price, but this is how much money I have, how much innovation can you give me for it, which really puts, I think, both the tools and like systems engineering, in a very different framework in terms of how we would look at it. Because that is saying, okay, this is all the money I got. How much am I going to get? There's another question, I think, that underlies that, though, that's fundamental to all of this, and that's where's innovation going to come from? We've not only had a paradigm shift, as Michael mentioned, in terms of how we approach the analytical basis to it. We've got a fundamental shift in the underpinning technology development dynamic of the planet, because the way DoD procured innovation in the past is basically it bought it, either under direct contract for basic research or with prime contractors who undertook it with the assumption they'd make the money back in production. Those models are really not very prevalent anymore, and they're going to be continuing to decline over time. That doesn't mean that we're not going to have innovation. I mean, I think, in fact, if you read through this volume, you'll see almost every author mentions something to the effect that innovation is part of the human character. It is going to happen. The real challenge is not where is innovation, how is innovation. It's how do we capture it, how do we bring it into the national security arena and take advantage of it, because it may be, in fact, being driven by commercial consumer items, which have sort of a different view of reliability and survivability than defense does. So I think there's a very fundamental challenge which parallels this but is embedded in it. And if we think of the speed versus complexity not as a linear equation but as a three-dimensional trade-off space, I think it gives us a whole different opportunity to do that. Sorry, I'll come back to you in a minute, David. We've got a couple that haven't talked in it before, you and you.
Okay, let me give you
identify yourself.
Ben Collins.
Thanks.
Quick background. I did 8 years, almost nine in the Army. I did the last six in Special Forces, and I got out in November. And one of the reasons that I got out with a few other officers touches on innovation and speed. And, sir, if I could give you a hug, I would. I might appear rambling and nervous just because I'm surrounded by Raytheons and Lockheed Martins and the Giants, but we looked at our requirements that we needed in the field and said, how can we address these needs and requirements now, 60 days, 90 days? I don't need a $50 million five-year project. And so something that my company, that we started, we said, well, number one, we had a problem dealing with human. There's massive amounts of human data, and how do we sift through it? So let's figure out how to do that. So a couple war fighters found some software people, some math, I was going to say nerds, but math geniuses, and we put together nerds, And we put together, and here we are. We're about 7 months, and we're about 90% done with one. The second problem we had was, especially in Afghanistan with the terrain and radio comms, we'd find ourselves waiting for CAS, close air support. It could be 30 minutes or it could be 2.5 hours, or you just might not get it, mission dependent. So what was a way that we on a team level could answer the mail to that? So what's especially with the ROE and with the political ramifications, what's a precision answer that we can utilize if we know that we're not going to get cast for 2.5 hours? So that was something we started looking at on a munitions level. So let me get my thoughts together. So listening to some of the discussion here, I'm almost scared. We're trying to answer a solution that we can put into the hands of the warfighter, because I'm in the National Guard. I know I'll be going back to Iraq in 2011. I know I would very much like to have some of the things that we're trying to put together. But it's a very difficult process for the – you know, we're not a huge company. We don't have humongous resources. We're doing it we're scrapping it. You know, we're looking, okay, we found a munitions guy, a nut in Texas that has the ability to form. So we're working there. We're answering the questions that we have. But I think that's where almost we need to go. We talked about the F-22. I love the A-10. Make me more A-10s. The F-22 pilot can't see what I'm looking at. The F-18 pilot goes by way too fast. The A-10 pilot can read my, you know, handwriting almost. There are solutions, and I'll stop with this, but I think out of great complexity can be simple answers if we're looking at something to answer a need now. A lot of this stuff we looked at to solve our munition question is off the shelf. We bought things from 5 different companies and mishmashed them together, and voila, it works. We had a problem breaching into certain doors, so we organized. We created a grill innovation on the ground. DOD came in and said, you got to take it off because you're not allowed to do that. We've got a company that's building a technology, and we'll get it to you as soon as we can. Okay. So that's all I have to say.
As you say that,
sorry.
You used a phrase that was really interesting, though, because it's at the heart of a lot of this. The ability to sort of manage complexity, because you can't engineer design, but the ability to manage complexity, you know you've succeeded when it looks simple. So your whole point about most of these answers are simple, I think, and if a systems engineer is the title in relative to a complicated system, you know, a complex systems engineer is really an ecosystem manager. Okay, and so I've been bereft in using the terms interchangeably, having it divided inside my head, but when I use the word systems engineer, I think about, you know, I would argue we should think about them in the two different contexts. So the TISWIG guys or the guys trying to solve the, you know, the IED problem, you cannot design an elegant solution to that. I'll give you another great example, which is a policy debate that was underway right now, UAVs and the control of UAVs and who's going to do it. And I was pretty vociferous in saying it is too early to be narrowing down the what appears to be redundancy today is actually innovation, experimentation, and you want to let it run because there is no clear answer today. 20 years from now, when it's a clear answer, it will be redundancy, and you want to get it, but not today. And so,
can I make a follow-on comment? I'll shut up. The warfighter needs to do 3 things: it needs to shoot, move, and communicate. And I'm getting an understanding now of systems integration. I understand. I have a Warlock or an ACOR. I've got something in the back of my truck to block the IEDs, yet every time I turn it on, my radio goes dead and I can't talk to the guy in front of me or behind me. If I want to talk to the birds, I got to shut everything down. If I want to talk to anybody, I got to go tell the Germans and the French to turn off whatever they're doing. That is a critical and I mean, you're talking about a truck. You know, you only got a finite amount of space. If there's going to be a system that you want to figure out, let's figure out how I can run an IED, how I can talk. I mean, that's – and fight. And you don't – you know, now with our trucks, I mean, I'm looking out of a window trying to command a fight like this. I mean, it's just – it seems like I hope we don't make it too complex. And if we answer
one of these days, requirements will come from users.
Right, which is why I put requirements at the top of the challenge list in terms of how we go forward, because we don't see it through that prism. We'll be dead. If you could click yours off there. I'm going to go to the fellow in the back, and then David Domkins is on. If somebody else is, I've got you. And okay. Let me make just a couple comments, and then I'll be glad to talk with you further after we finish. I think that one of the things that happens in trying to tackle tough problems in the national security arena is that there's a little bit of a pendulum cycle. There are opportunities where, in fact, there are a lot of forces lined up where a number of important things can take place. And most of us spend our lives trying to make sure that we keep the issues alive and keep the work going on so that when those opportunities do open up, we can sort of coagulate and although coagulation is probably the wrong noun to come into play, because what you're really trying to do is decoagulate and flow through the interstices of those opportunities. And I think we're at that place right now. In an interesting way, defense has moved from being the number one issue on the political plate to taking a backseat, obviously, to economic recovery. And that makes perfect sense. But I think it gives – there's a little bit of time for the national security arena to figure out what the heck to do and to put those elements into play. And I think you'll see that with the new administration, and particularly as they begin to put together not only the FY10 amendment to whatever that budget is, but most particularly the FY11 budget and the associated future year defense program that goes with it. So I think there really is a marvelous opportunity just from a timing point of view that happens to fit with the change in administrations as well. And I think there'll be a lot of effort to take advantage of that opportunity. I'll be glad to talk with you further there. Let me go back to David and then over here against the wall.
Douglas's comment to me was very much the center of this whole issue. We're looking towards adaptive, evolving systems. And it's the architecture and process over their life cycle, the journey management, that becomes a critical issue. So systems architecture and journey management and the standardisation of processes that can deal with that become the core to this stuff. I think if we've learned anything in Australia, again, small country, much of what we've learned in this sorts of work came from areas other than defence. It came from working on mining projects, working with people on the floor in rail projects out in the middle of the desert where we have nothing. We haven't got the huge volume of money available that you have. We very much have to improvise with what we've got, and it's very much top-down, bottom-up driven. And if you don't do that, if you haven't got a system that works with the people on the floor and satisfy their needs, we don't work. And so it's totally driven by that. The last thing I'd say, I was fairly heavy at the front when I said about the American government not participating. The one place that's an exception to that has been this forum. And to my mind, this is a delight. Because there's very few places in the world I can have this sort of company to have this discussion. Very few. And I'd be very sad to see this project end and hope that there is some future beyond this.
I should note for the record, especially now that the camera's gone, that
Careful, you have
UPI. Right. That we do have plans to move forward with phase two, but that is at the moment largely unfunded, so it has some narrow natural limits that will be associated with it. But I agree with you completely. I think that this issue and this group of people who have worked on it absolutely needs to be kept going and move forward. Let me go with you and then back to...
Can I just quickly comment? The physicist in me, has really this past year on our project taken a real backseat to the sociologist in me, which has really come to the fore.
Which is again is why at the heart of this we kept going to the governance models, we kept going to more the social, political. We found out that the more we delved into this, we came back with the answers. This is not a technical problem. This is not an engineering problem. And the word governance is a shorthand for all these other topics. It's how do you create an ecosystem or an ecology or whatever phrases you want to use. And again, part of the thing is we're all still defining what the heck this means. You could do a book on just defining terms, to let alone get a common
but
basis.
I just want to make sure that we don't short shrift the technology for the simple reason that the idea that you're going to do for the people, particularly from the large company and government people represented in this room, the idea that you're going to have agile SAP or agile Oracle finance. I can design, trust me, I can design a technical system which gets in the way of everything that we're talking about in terms of cycle time, development, enhancement, versus Google, where you can do MapQuest, you can do all you can do ISR kind of stuff, right? So as much you need to be both the sociologist and the physicist, and the right. I just don't like the right brain left brain dichotomy, because the institutionalized schizophrenia strikes me as bad design. So.
But I think the point is, in the engineering community, which of course I've spent years and years in, the sociologist is not even understood or on their radar screen.
Come to MIT.
Well, MIT is different.
Yeah, but you're going back to defense-centric projects. I currently lead a program to develop a post-oil economy in UAE, in the United Arab Emirates. So my charge is to convert a country from an oil economy to something that's self-productive long-term and take employment of Emirates, et cetera. It's got nothing to do with technology. It's a change program that involves managing, bringing technologies in, cultural change. They're the sort of programs that are equally complex other than defense. And technology is very much a subset of what we deal with.
Also why, which is why it's important. The problem with this debate, too, is you operate at different levels simultaneously as you talk through it. And if we wanted to be really good about this, we'd sit there and all flag our comments, say, I'm going to talk about this from this level and all that. Because in the end, after you do all this nice ecosystem management, somebody still has to design that left bracket. Somebody still has to do the hardcore engineering of how do I get this to talk to that, which is why talking about and sort of saying, okay, if I move to this whole world, I can get rid of all these other guys is ridiculous, because somebody still has to do the detailed engineering work, you know, that goes through in the execution of the job. So part of this debate is, in some ways, again, is up at that top level of which mechanism are we using, but never forget that in the end there's real work to be done.
I want to give our DOD person a chance to comment here, and then we'll go to Jeremy.
I hope it doesn't come to that it's one or the other. It's either a systems engineering problem or it's a policy and governance problem, because I think that what we're seeing is a paradigm shift, to borrow your term, but in a merging of these two disciplines where, and I don't think that you two gentlemen are at odds either about saying too much up front and too early or your needs in the field are at all at odds, because this upfront knowledge base that we want to provide to the policymakers and the leaders and the budgeters from a technical standpoint needs to very much inform those decisions in order that we can have a better understanding down the road, right? But part of that upfront knowledge and risk that we're going to provide is going to be in terms of how can I build my systems to help them to think through how to build them in a more adaptable manner. What's my architecture that I want to lay out? So it's very much all engaged in this, what I was probably just, you know, simplistically referring to as, you know, early systems engineering engagement. So it very much is this, not one or the other, but it must be a merging. So thank you, David.
Jeremy, why don't you make a comment, and then I think we're going to try to wrap it up and close on time here. Let me suggest also that on this dimension of left brain, right brain, of technology versus governance, you know, if you give this challenge to DOD, and many of us have spent our lives working in, for, or around, or against, or with the Department of Defense, they will turn the question into the question of who's in charge. Because that's actually the only answer, the only issue DOD really likes to wrestle with. And this is your problem that you had with, you know, I've already got a contract and I got somebody working on this, all the way up to who's running the ACAT-1 program review process and who gets to decide, et cetera. And when you focus on the who instead of the what, you will in fact ultimately end up with an organizational decision rather than a governance decision. And all you ever do in that circumstance is you may have a different tree, but you've got the same monkeys. And so, you know, you really need to figure out a way to
is that
play.
Governance
you know, I've climbed a lot of different trees, and all the monkeys are always still there when you get up in the new tree. And I think that the value of this group and this exercise and what you have brought individually and collectively to it is we will, among other things, prevent ourselves from rushing back to that same decision path that we tend to fall into very quickly inside the national security arena. In fact, you see it, you know, our project on National Security Forum ultimately ended up, as much as anything, a project on national security reorganization, which was not what we were trying to do. But there's always another phase. And David, I think that's go back to my opening comments. I look forward to the continued support and involvement of you all as we move forward on this phase two and our attempt not only to move the ball here intellectually, but actually to affect the governance and the implementation, which is going to be so critically needed over time. And I'm not going to ask for any commitment of support from Ms. Baldwin, but I hope that, I'm not asking in terms of monetary support, but intellectual support and interest, because I really do think the only way we can succeed is if we've got the engagement of the government as we go through this process. Do you have any final words before we close up?
I think just to echo what I said in the beginning, this is an important area, and as I hope I conveyed, it's an area of continued interest. So we very much are at least intellectually engaged with your way forward, and I thank you again for your contribution and the very good debate.